Hello and welcome to the fourth ever episode of The Europeans. Can you believe it's the fourth episode already, Katie?
What can I say, Dominic? Time flies when you're having fun, eh?
Well, this is our fourth and final before Christmas because we've decided we're going to take a little break over the Christmas break as people who have been working very hard.
Yeah, I think it's time for us to get a bit Christmassy. I've got the tree up here in Paris. It's a very short Christmas tree. Some people have been laughing at it cruelly, but it packs a lot of punch, you know? And you've been having a Christmassy time over there in Amsterdam too, I think.
I have been having a wonderful Christmas time and singing lots of Christmas carols on daytime TV in the Netherlands.
Ooh, glamorous.
Yeah, it really wasn't glamorous at all. It actually felt quite sad.
Why?
Because it's like, it's so pretend. Everything's being done so quickly and manically because it's live TV, and everyone behind the camera is really miserable, and everyone in front of the camera is pretending to be really happy. So it made me sad.
Was it still festive nonetheless?
Yeah, kind of, because there was snow.
Oh, what, fake snow?
No, real snow, left over.
Oh, nice. And did you say that you were singing in multiple European languages?
Yes, in fact, this afternoon I'm going to do a carol concert at the National Opera here, and we're singing in, I think, about four European languages: Czech, English, Dutch, and German. So carols from across Europe.
What a good pan-European you are. Just as pan-European as this episode, actually. We've been concentrating for the first 3 weeks of the show mostly on stuff that's been happening within individual countries in Europe. But this week, we're going to try something a little bit different and talk about a couple of cross-European issues. Firstly, we're going to be asking why the corridors of power in Brussels are so overwhelmingly white.
Then we are going to talk about the European Parliament nearly making themselves very unpopular this week by passing a law to ban phosphates that are used in kebabs.
The juicy maker. More on that later. And then we're going to have a little fun with a roundup of the words of the year around the continent. So we're going to give Ryan a ring, Ryan Heath from Politico. If you're listening to this, you're probably already signed up to his morning newsletter, The Brussels Playbook. But if you're not, do so immediately. It is the daily guide to what's going on around the European Union. And this week, Ryan's been doing a lot of reporting about racial diversity within the EU in Brussels, or rather the shocking lack of it. Like, if you walk into the EU Commission, the staff there working there are going to be a lot whiter than even the rest of Brussels, let alone the rest of the wider EU. So Ryan's been starting a conversation about that this week under the hashtag Brussels So White. And we thought we'd give him a call to see how it's been going.
Hi guys, how are you?
Hey Ryan, how are you?
Very good.
Hi Ryan.
Could you kick us off by giving us a couple of facts and figures that illustrate just how white Brussels is?
Yeah, it's about a year ago now that I was scrolling through some of the web pages of the European Union, and I think I was looking up MEPs, and I was going to begin checking into whether they were doing anything dodgy with their finances. And I just started seeing a lot of white faces. And I had a couple of hours to spare, and I actually went through all of the members of the European Parliament, then all of the members of the commissioner teams, and then all of the ambassador photos. And as best I could figure out, the town is literally 99% white in its decision-making elite. And so by 99% white, I mean there's literally between 12 and 16, depending on how you want to define it, out of 751 MEPs who could be classified as something other than Caucasian. There are no commissioners, there are no EU ambassadors, and it doesn't really get into anything that approaches diverse until you start looking at NATO, the military alliance. And that's mostly because Turkey and the United States are in NATO.
Wow. One of the things I found most shocking was not only that it's so white, but that there aren't any official figures. No information's been collected.
Exactly. So I understand why in some countries that's not allowed. In France in particular, it's very much seen as an attempt to end racism, that people shouldn't be labelled or defined according to their family background. Now, you can have arguments for and against it, but at least it's a sort of a clear system. The EU seems to have just fallen into that trap, kind of following in France's footsteps, not because anyone actively decided that was the way to do it or not. And where it becomes a little bit hypocritical and problematic, sort of beyond the immediate thing of how diverse are we in Brussels, is that a lot of these officials actually request national governments collect information like this, for example, on the Roma minority, or even inside their own institutions, on the number of women in senior management, for example, or making sure there's a balance between the different countries. So they don't have any problem with quotas and number targets for different groups of people. And they also don't have any problem asking other people to collect data. They just don't happen to collect it themselves.
Why is this such a bad problem, Ryan?
Well, I think first and foremost, the European Union has had a lot of other challenges, let's say. You know, the primary goal is let's stop war. So they're focused on that rather than some of these other bits and pieces. And the EU, compared to other countries like the United States or where I'm from, Australia, it is less of a melting pot. It's absolutely true. But at the same time, as best we can figure out, there are around about 60 million Europeans who have some other heritage other than sort of the native Caucasian population in the country where they come from. And that's where it becomes a bit of a problem when you start saying, it's only 12% of the population. Well, 12% out of 500 million is 60 million, and that's a lot of people.
I guess a lot of the problem, it comes from the individual countries themselves. And to what extent can Brussels or the EU institutions be blamed for this? I mean, it's kind of a shared responsibility, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So I think my response to that would be first to accept that, yes, in some countries there are very, very small non-white populations. You know, we're talking 1% to 2% of the population. So obviously those countries are going to experience this issue or this criticism differently to a country like the UK, where, you know, we're getting closer to 20% of the population and where they do have a very good system for monitoring and including and so on. So it does vary from country to country. But at the end of the day, I think that the EU's job is to be some kind of role model. And I think that if it's not willing to at least examine itself, then that's when there's a real issue. Now, obviously, you can't just separate out race or ethnicity from other issues, where if education systems are biased in a particular way, for example, or, you know, people hire people like themselves generally. So, you know, it's understandable that if an older generation of European officials was largely white, then there needs to be some kind of transition period or some kind of specific system to make sure they don't just hire people that look like themselves. But it doesn't mean that they're individually to blame. So if everyone at the College of Europe training school is white, then that's going to increase the chances that all the people applying for the positions at the EU are white as well.
For me as a mixed race person, it's something that really bugs me, you know, because I mean, maybe for some people it isn't that important, but I do wonder if, I don't know, maybe people might feel a bit less disconnected from the EU if it resembled us better.
Yeah, I would say that as well. So there's clearly a growing non-white population. And I don't want to even define that population as the other. Think about the labels we're using here. It's automatically the other by using terms like non-white. But it is growing. And those people, as best we can figure out, are more supportive of the EU and more likely to identify as European rather than just through the country that they're living in terms of their own personal identity. So it's a very good opportunity for those pan-European political parties or those people that want the EU to thrive and are against Brexit and so on. So it's, I mean, I would really want to frame it in terms of opportunities rather than a problem that people, or a burden that people have to take on. But I think we've got a more fundamental issue where a lot of people just do not see racism as something that happens in Europe or something that concerns them. It's not that they're trying to be horrible people, but they think of racism as something that happens to Aboriginal Australians or African Americans. And it's just, they blank when you confront them with this issue. And they kind of, they can't grapple with the idea of darker skinned people doing something other than cleaning things or serving things.
There are some real horror stories in your coverage this week about the kind of experience people have had of racism in Brussels. I think there was a guy who got handed a glass at an event because people assumed he was a waiter, right? Oh, you're black. You must be here to serve people. What was the most shocking story you heard while reporting this?
The one that personally affected me the most was a woman called Rachel Moore. And so she, her family background is African, and she lives in Belgium, but she's British by nationality. And she worked for a right-wing MEP. But what she had to go through was just disgusting, and it shouldn't happen to anybody, where people would literally kind of not really accept that it was her that was collecting them at the front door at the European Parliament, or they would just refuse to talk to her in meetings. And it meant that she censored herself, that she just didn't go to some meetings, and she said it really played on her daily life. And yeah, it was really heartbreaking to sit there and hear her tell me that. And then the one that I experienced that I think is the most, like, icky was a skin cancer screening event that was taking place at the European Parliament. And I'm from Australia, so I take skin cancer very seriously. I'm quite certain I'm going to get it at one point in my life. So I was like, great, if I can encourage Europeans to avoid that problem, I'm going to get in there and do it and make myself a role model. So I headed down there. I went in to see the doctor and everything. That was all fine. And then there was a public element of the event for people who didn't want to go through the full doctor screening. And that was where you sat in front of a UV special camera and it would show you the existing skin damage on your face, and then you would apply sunscreen. And the camera would show you if you'd applied it correctly or not, because where you put the sunscreen would come as these big black marks across your face. And so the idea was to get your face as black as possible. And even I didn't really go through that process. I was a bit like, oh, okay, whatever. Okay, look, I've applied it so well. Look how black my face is. Then they said, let's take a photo and put it on Twitter. And then I took the photo. And then I looked at it, and they're like, is this okay? And then I went, I've just done blackface. And then, it's not even the punchline, not even the punchline, Katie. And then I said, okay, so can I just check, what happens if a black person comes here? Like, it shows up white on them, doesn't it? And they went, oh, no, sorry, it doesn't really work on black people. So we've just been avoiding people with dark skin all week in the corridors.
Oh, no. And it sounds like they wouldn't have had to try very hard to avoid people who aren't white as well in that building.
Literally did not have words. I just sat there and went, literally didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I just remembered it all, wrote it down in a notebook as soon as I could run away, and then was like, one day we're going to put this in a journalism piece. And that day was this week.
How have people reacted this week within the Brussels community? Do you feel like people are ready to listen to this, or do people just want to deny it?
It's really sharply divided. I would put it into three categories. The first are the people who are, I guess, like the three of us, are just a bit horrified by it all, and who come from countries or perspectives where it's normal to think about these things, or you've been exposed to it for quite a long time, so you've come to accept it. And they just find it a real culture clash and something that they've always had to bite their tongue about. Or they felt it, but they didn't have anyone verbalize it before, and now it's a bit cathartic for them to be able to talk about it. Then you have the category of people who, I guess, are a little bit surprised by this, you know, the kind of convertible people who you can take them from not realizing it was a problem to saying, yeah, we should talk about this. Then you probably have another third of people who are just flat out like, no, this is ridiculous. You're just bashing the EU. You know, we've had such a struggle just to get women into management. Stop annoying us with this policy. You know, this, I mean, why would we write a whole policy just for three people anyway? And they're just really resistant to the idea. They're always white. I've never had a person of color at all say, go away, stop talking about this. But there was a couple of people of color who said, look, I've never faced any direct discrimination. We do have issues to talk about. It starts in the national education systems, but don't blame the EU for this. And I thought, you know, that's fair feedback. You know, people who have fought their way through the system don't want to be told that they achieved it only through a target or a quota or something like that. And so I think that's important to factor those feelings and those risks into any discussion about this. But it's not a reason to avoid the discussion, in my view.
I feel like the EU has been a little bit more fun than normal this week, because there's been a lot of talk about kebabs, something dear to my heart. And incidentally, something that I think we should recognise as something that truly makes us all European, you know? They really are beloved by drunk people literally all over the continent. Anyway, basically, the EU Parliament nearly voted to ban the use of phosphates as an additive in the kind of big twirly meat spits that you see in kebab shops, over fears that they might cause heart disease. That didn't happen. But in any case, a lot of the press coverage was like, they're going to ban kebabs. But just to be clear, that was never going to happen. It was fake news. Or falske nyheter, as they say in Norway.
Oh, we'll come to that later. I saw that the centre-right European People's Party tweeted, we saved your kebab. You're welcome. Which I thought was firstly very humble of them. But secondly, yeah, not quite true, because actually I saw an interview with someone from like the International Kebab Association. I don't think that's actually what it's called, but I can't remember. And they said, oh yeah, we could have just replaced the phosphates with something else if it had been banned.
Yeah, exactly. They could use something else, but at the moment, phosphates are really widely used to make the meat kind of stick together better and stay nice and juicy. And it was actually the Germans who were pushing for the chemicals to stay. They have quite an interesting role in the European kebab industry. They make nearly 80% of Europe's doner meat, and it's an industry that employs 11,000 people. So the industry was basically saying, look, let's ban it when we've proven that it's dangerous. Make of that logic what you will.
But it's not the end. The European Food Standards Agency are doing their own research into the health concerns, so look out, phosphates. Europe is coming for you. It's that time of year, Katie, when all these different organizations and dictionaries and countries seem to be listing their words of the year. I don't know how long this has been going on for, but it's really like exploded into a thing, hasn't it? I'm not sure how useful it is.
We don't really have it in France. We do have new words added to the dictionary every year, but it's not like a Christmassy thing. And it definitely feels like an end of year thing in England, where it's, you know, it's like a new story every year. Word of the year.
So this year, the Oxford Dictionary has named youthquake as its word of the year in the UK.
Not a word.
It's an amalgamation of youth and earthquake, as you may have deduced. Used, but I'd never heard it used. Had you?
Well, that's because you're not young and cool, because obviously it's a word that's used by young and cool people. Except, oh wait, it's not. It's one of those words that's used by old people trying to sound young and cool. Like, hey guys, nice youthquake. Barely anyone's heard it, but apparently it's something that's been used a lot more in 2017. And as you can probably guess, it means a political awakening of young people, which I guess, to be fair, is something that we have seen in Britain in the past year with a lot of young people voting for Jeremy Corbyn. What was it last year?
Post-truth.
Yeah, which was very zeitgeist, I guess.
And this year, quite a few countries have gone with, like, fake news. Or Norway have gone with fake news, haven't they?
Yes, falske nyheter. Norwegian listeners, you can call in and tell me how badly I massacred pronouncing that.
Yeah.
They basically said it was mostly about its use in the US, which does seem a little bit behind the times, Norway. But also a word that's come up in Norway itself a lot this year because they've had quite a negative election campaign.
And Germany, the Society for German Language went for Jamaica aus, or Jamaica out in English, which is in reference to the Jamaica coalition that was a possibility after the recent German election. But I also found that a really weird choice. Like, did anyone actually say Jamaica House? And also it's a compound word.
Yeah, but they love compound words in German, don't they?
Yeah, that's true.
In French-speaking Switzerland, they've picked harcèlement, which means harassment. Makes sense, given how much we've been talking about that subject this year.
Yeah. And German-speaking Switzerland chose me too.
Yeah, but the one that we really want to talk about is the Netherlands, because you guys have had the most hated word chosen, haven't you, Dominic? And it's an interesting choice, gender neutral.
Yeah, or most irritating word of the year. It was voted for by 22,000 Dutch people. So should we give my brother-in-law Jonah a call about this?
Yeah, but tell us why Jonah was the perfect person to talk about it.
So Jonah Lamers is a trans activist and educator in the area of gender studies. He is just a very interesting person to talk to about this, I thought.
Hello, Dominic.
And me. I'm here too, Joe.
Hey, Katie. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're good. We've just been talking about this kind of surprising choice. Well, to me, it's surprising anyway. Of gender neutral as a word of the year in the Netherlands.
I was wondering to what extent it's most hated because it's partly an English word. Is that something that people hate?
No, I don't think so, because they either pronounce it here as gender neutral or gender neutral. We kind of colonized the word gender because it doesn't exist in Dutch language. We only have the word sex, basically, and we use it interchangeably. We took that word from the English language. But neutral is a Dutch word too. So I don't think that's it.
Do you have any sense of, in day-to-day life, of people being against this idea of gender neutrality? Do you think it's like shaking people and upsetting people?
Oh, yes, it certainly is. And I'm maybe for some context, I'm transgender myself. You hear a female voice. However, I do certainly identify as a guy. So that's confusing to a lot of people. And I have a collective with two other trans guys, and we make audiovisual productions on the topic of gender diversity and transgender. So we're also we have a platform on YouTube and on Facebook, and we post videos on these topics. And among those videos was a video that I spoke in on the topic of gender neutrality, and it went viral. So there was a lot of interest in the topic, but also a lot of backlash, which was interesting to see. And with every like also public debate that we have, this annoyance comes up. People have strong feelings about this topic, and I think I've figured out what it is that they're so annoyed with.
What?
I have to confess that I'm one of the people that is really annoyed with the word gender neutral, and that maybe sounds strange coming from me, but I think it's the wrong word, because I think the debate is actually about creating more space in public spaces for the diversity that is already here, but that's kind of kept invisible because we try to adhere to this binary so much in mainstream society. Everything is male, female, everything is heterosexual, everything is feminine versus masculine. These are the images that we are imprinted with constantly, but there's always been a huge diversity in people, of course. So it's not gender neutral that we want, it is gender diversity. Gender neutral is just the wrong word because it has a connotation of deleting individuality or deleting diversity. Everybody is the same.
Yeah.
I've got to say, as a foreigner who has visited the Netherlands quite a lot, I've kind of got this image in my head of the Netherlands as a country that's tolerant, likes to think of itself as open-minded. Is that image just wrong?
It's very difficult. So here in the Netherlands, we have a very famous saying. We use it all the time. And basically, if you translate it to English, it is act normal. Do normaal. Being normal here is very much appreciated. It's kind of a contrast then in what everybody thinks that the Netherlands is, free-thinking, open-minded society, which of course there's still aspects of it here, but I think the general population really just wants to be normal.
So I saw that some of the fuss was caused by HEMA, which is this chain. You probably have it in the country where you live. It's around in quite a lot of different European countries now. It's a chain store that sells all kinds of things at quite low prices. Some of this fuss was caused by HEMA selling a gender-neutral range of clothes for kids. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually really ridiculous if you think about it, because what has happened is that indeed HEMA, it's a big Dutch brand. Basically, the most normal thing you can get, and everybody loves it. I'm also a lover of HEMA. They have everything you need. What they did was they took away the signs, these are boys' clothes and these are girls' clothes. So everybody can just choose whatever they want.
Which is such a nice idea.
Exactly. In essence, it sounds super great. What happens is actually they are trying to create more individuality. But again, I think the problem is this stupid word gender neutral that people just are really freaked out about because they feel like something is taken away from them. They feel like their identity is being stripped away from them. On the contrary, actually, you have more room to explore your identity. But I think in this society, we just really like the boxes.
Yeah. Well, gender neutral was this year's most irritating word of the year. But I see that last year it was diervriendelijk, which means animal friendly. So I feel like gender neutral is a good company here. I mean, who hates being friendly to animals?
You know, the Dutch, I think they just get sick of things really fast. If something that doesn't really, you know, isn't a necessary topic for them personally to discuss, but is discussed constantly, they get annoyed.
Yeah.
It's a luxury problem. The Dutch are just funny people. Of course, you know, we all would like to be animal friendly. At least I would hope so.
Final question, Joe. What would you pick as your word of the year?
That is a great question. I think I'm going to toot my own horn a little bit, but I'm going to say my favorite word of the year is transketeers.
Yeah.
The name of my collective. And I think we've worked really, really hard and I'm very proud of my guys. You know, we're trying to cause some waves and it's kind of happening. So I think I'm going to pick that as a personal favorite word of the year.
Where can we find you on the internet?
We are on YouTube and Facebook. All our Dutch things have English subtitles and we're now switching more and more to English.
Great. Well, check them out. They produce lots of really interesting and informative and fun content. So do it. It's a happy ending for millennials this week, and actually only for the millennials in the UK, I'm afraid. Sorry. We might have to move back, Katie, because Marks and Spencer's, the much-loved British retailer, may have recently announced that they are closing lots of their international stores, including many in the EU, but their fortunes are turning because they have just launched a new type of avocado that don't have a stone inside.
What? That's not possible.
No, well, it is. It's created by growing unpollinated avocados. So they're really small. They're like cocktail avocados. And apparently the skin is edible.
So you know how M&S sell like mini cocktail sausages? Are they kind of that size?
Yes.
Whoa.
I think they are about that size. So, I mean, it's not only good news for avocado lovers, but it could also be the thing that saves the National Health Service in the UK, which is been struggling under the weight of all these people coming in to accident and emergency departments with what has been dubbed avocado hand, the thing where you accidentally stab yourself whilst trying to remove the avocado stone with a knife.
Oh, so that's the reason why the NHS is nearly collapsing. Okay, I didn't realise that.
Exactly. It's not anything to do with the funding crisis or an ageing population. No, no. It's just to do with avocados.
Oh, that's terrible. So when am I able to get my hands on these teeny weeny avocados?
So they're in very short supply. They're only going to be available in December because that's when they're harvest. And they're...
Next December?
No, this December.
Oh.
But you're going to have to get in there quick because there aren't going to be many of them. I've been really amazed actually looking across the internet. Almost all of the articles were like... Finally, they've created a safe avocado. It's so ridiculous to think that avocados are these things that people think are so dangerous. But then when I think back on it, I have nearly cut myself quite a few times trying to get a stone out of an avocado.
Your life is very hard.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. We hope that you have a wonderful Christmas time as... Who was it who said that?
Simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
Paul McCartney? Yeah, it was Paul McCartney and Wings.
Oh, was it actually Wings?
It was Wings, yeah. That great European band.
Anyway, we're getting distracted.
Sorry.
Everybody, have a great Christmas and do send us pictures of different Christmassy things you're doing across Europe. We will retweet them to our many, many followers.
And sex bots.
Yes, we've been making lots of new friends on Twitter. Most of them very proud Europeans, which has been lovely to see. But some of them accounts that... don't seem to be real people, but do have pictures of some very busty ladies. But yeah, thank you for your support, ladies. The more the merrier. You can follow us on Twitter at EuropeansPod.
You can go to our website, which is EuropeansPodcast.com.
We're on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. And you can email us if you really want to on EuropeansPodcast@gmail.com.
Katie, don't discourage people. They can email us if they even slightly want to.
No, we absolutely encourage you to send us emails.
We love getting emails.
Emails. Thanks as ever to Jim Barn for our music. His jingles are as delicious as the phosphates in your kebab.
And thank you to our wonderful guests this week. Ryan Heath from Politico. Don't forget to subscribe to his Brussels playbook if you haven't already. And Jonah Lamers, my brother-in-law. Check out the Transketeers on Facebook and on YouTube. They produce really interesting and informative videos about trans issues.
Happy Christmas from the Europeans, and we'll see you in 2018.
Joyeux Noël!
How do I say it in Dutch?
Prettige kerst. Tijd. Thomas, how do you say it in Dutch? Prettige kerstdagen.
Yeah, what he said.